A man in South Florida came into a restaurant, a rather irritated man, and the service was slow. And so he called out to the waitress, "Ma'am, do you serve crabs here?" She said, "We serve anybody here, and I'll be right over there in just a minute." How important is attitude? During these morning sessions, we're talking about Matthew chapter 5, which is the Beatitudes of my Lord. And each day we're taking two or three of them, and we're going to exhaust the list. Today I want to take three. And I have a clock right in front of me, and so you relax, and I'll stop on time, and you won't have to worry about getting back to work. If I have to stop before I'm finished, that'll be all right. I'll just stop. Attitude is important because attitude ultimately determines behavior. As I said yesterday, we don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. How about your attitude today? Is your attitude good toward your family? I mean, do you have a good attitude towards your wife? How about towards your husband? Towards your children or your parents? How's your attitude toward the church? What about our attitudes? Here's the next one. Jesus said, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." The word meek has taken a real blow the last few years. If I ask people commonly, just common society, to define meek or meekness, what would they say? Well, it would have something to do with weakness, that meekness is ineffective. Meekness means someone who is perhaps quiet or inefficient or not very qualified, laid back. But that's not the meaning at all. As a matter of fact, Matthew 11 and 28 describes, you know what the Bible says. My Lord said, "I am meek and lowly in heart." Jesus was meek. Was he weak, ineffective? No. Truth is, the opposite. Jesus was very strong. In Numbers chapter 12 and verse 3, the Bible speaks of Moses. Now, this verse has been a real sticking point for those who want to say that Moses didn't write the Pentateuch, that Moses didn't write the first five books of the Bible, because this verse says, now Moses was very meek above all the men of the earth. He was the meekest man in all the earth. And the argument goes, how could Moses say that about himself? If he wrote this, how could he make the claim that he was the meekest man in all the earth? Well, that's a misunderstanding of the word meek. You see, in the context, Moses was facing his brother and sister. What were their names again? Miriam and Aaron. And they had come to Moses to say, "We think you're just taking too much on you. You know what? You married this Cushite woman." And now God had not prohibited that, but they did. They were offended by it. They didn't like her. They didn't want him to marry her. And besides that, they said, "You know, you just take too much. You have presumed to take this position." And of course, I'm paraphrasing now, of leadership over Israel. "Don't you think we're righteous too? Don't you think God talks by us just like he talks by you?" And it was as if to say, you know, you have just personally assumed this position of authority. And Moses begged him, because see, Moses knew the truth. Moses knew that he didn't just assume this position, that God put him in this position. And for Miriam and Aaron to speak against Moses was to speak against God. And so he said, "Please don't talk like this. Please don't talk like this." It was in this context that the Bible says that Moses was the meekest man in all the earth. Now, the word meek means, and this is Glenn's definition, meek means having a cause bigger than yourself. It was an admission by Moses to say, "It's not that I've assumed this position of power because I love power. It's because I love God's people. I'm not into clout. I'm into service." It's having a cause bigger than yourself. Now, meekness is power under control. So Aristotle talked a lot about meekness. Aristotle said that meekness could be measured in anger, and that a meek man was one who was never angry at the wrong time and was always angry at the right time. Power under control. And so if you want to break a horse, you know, you think the best time to break a horse is when she's maybe 1,000, 1,200 pounds. About 2 years old, best time to break a horse, I suppose. And you look at that massive animal, muscle and skin and bones and sinew, and just a powerful animal. But now, that horse's nature is not to be ridden. You got to break that horse or train that horse. I mean, a horse is a flight animal. You walk up to a wild horse, I mean, if you could get close enough, and just go ahead and poke that horse, that massive animal, with your finger, and you'll know what I'm talking about. I mean, she's going to bolt. She's going to go crazy and run as fast as she can because she's not used to that, right? Now, what you do is that you start training that horse not to be bothered by poking or touching or you take a blanket, and every day you throw a blanket on her back, right? Get her used to having some weight up there, and eventually a saddle. Now, horses are herding animals, and they're used to following a leader, typically a horse. Now that leader has to be you. And so you bridle that horse, and you'd walk her along beside you and teach her that she's not to run into you. And when you stop, she stops. And when you go, she goes. And when you turn, she's to turn. And so gradually you'd bring that about where she is beautifully trained. Isn't it wonderful to see a horse that is so beautifully, perfectly trained to that master, following that master? Now, wait a minute. That horse is still 1,200 pounds. That is the same horse we talked about a while ago. Massive bones and sinew and muscles and skin, a massive animal, but now different. Now, folks, that's meekness. That's power, but under control. Now, don't you have some place you could be right now besides right here? What are you doing here? Why are you here? You got other stuff to do. You have things that you might enjoy doing besides being here at lunchtime. What are you doing here? Well, you're interested in the Lord. You see, you're interested in having a kind of life, the best life, that comes by serving God. And so you came to enjoy being with Christians. You want to make these relationships, develop these relationships, and you want to ponder in the middle of the day, you want to ponder the things of God, and that's why you're here. Don't have to be. Nobody made you do it. But that's meekness. So I don't know who in this room is a Christian and who's not, but I can tell you one thing, whether or not you are, you've got some characteristics of meekness in you. Meekness is power under control. You know what God said to Cain? You know Cain and Abel? God said to Cain, if you do well, you'll be accepted. If not, sin lies at the door. And the point is that God is not going to make you do right. He's never going to force you to be a Christian. He's never going to force you to do right. You do right because you choose to do right. You do right because that's what you want to do, not because he makes you or coerces you. That's meekness. It is power under control. It is having a cause bigger than oneself. So the Lord's Day comes, and the plate is passed, and you put money in that plate. Haven't you got other things you could spend your money on? Haven't you got things you'd like to buy with that money? Haven't you got things you'd enjoy purchasing with that? Well, yeah, but that's not the point. You put it in the plate. Why? Why do you do that? That's meekness. Meekness is power. You've got that power over that money, but it's under control. And you say, I know that this money is going to go to feed the poor. This money is going to go to teach the lost. This money is going to go to the work of the church. And I know this pleases the Lord, and I want to please the Lord. So strength is strength, but it's strength under control. And so you put it. So you get angry with your husband. You get angry with your wife. You get angry with your coworker. And you know what? We might have a natural inclination to just blow our top, just to let them have it. You might even have the inclination to curse somebody when you're really angry. Well, just let them have it. You know those words. You know how to, you could curse them, but you don't do it. Why not? You've got the power, don't you? But you don't do it. Why not? Because you know it wouldn't please the Lord. It'd break relationships. It would be destructive to your life. And so despite the fact, like that horse, despite the fact that you've got that power, you got power under control, and you've got a cause that's bigger than yourself. Now that's meekness. Blessed are they that hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Could you define righteousness? Now righteousness is not an attitude. Righteousness is actions. You get to verse 10 of Matthew 5, and he says, now, blessed are those of you which are persecuted for righteousness' sake. I would argue that righteousness then is something that the people could see. Other people could see in you, and you're going to be persecuted for righteousness' sake. They see your actions, the way that you live, and then they respond in this way. Well, Jesus was baptized to fulfill all righteousness, right? Righteousness is doing the right thing. But you know what? That's not really what this beatitude is. I mean, this beatitude is an attitude. Are you ready? He's not talking about what is righteousness. He's talking about an attitude. Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after this. That's who he's talking to, or what he's talking about. Do we hunger and thirst after righteousness? What does that mean? Righteousness is, are you ready? Doing the right thing. That's it. Righteousness is doing the right thing. Now, are you hungry to do the right thing in your life? Now, let me make it more specific. Are you really serious about doing the right thing with reference to your wife? I mean, treating her in the right way. Is that what you desire? Or how about in the way you treat your husband? Do you hunger and thirst after doing the right thing toward your husband or your wife or your children? What about your employer? You know, a lot of people aren't so terribly concerned about doing the right thing toward their employer. And when the employer's not watching, they're not going to work, right? And if they have a chance to steal from him or from her, they're going to steal. If I don't think he knows it, I can just benefit from this. There's no hungering and thirsting after doing the right thing. What about doing the right thing with reference to your God? Do you hunger and thirst after that? You know, we talk about integrity being an idea in my heart that I do the right thing when nobody's watching. That's integrity, isn't it? Well, what about that hungering and thirsting after doing the right thing because I really want to please God? I mean, I believe that there is a God in heaven. And I know that he watches us, and I want to do right by him. Now, that's who this is talking about. Blessed are they who do hunger and thirst after righteousness means I really want to do the right thing in my life. Now here's the fourth, or the third, rather. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. You know what? That sounds very pithy. It's very poetic, isn't it? Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. But I want you to hear me. This is not poetry. This is an alarm clock. I mean, this is significant because he says, my showing you mercy, God speaking, or the Lord speaking, my showing you mercy is tied to whether or not you're merciful. Are you a merciful person? I mean, is this something which is characteristic of you? Now, how would you define merciful? It's found in the Bible. Mercy or merciful, found in the Bible about 30 times. And you might say it means sympathy. And I think that's a close, it's not exactly a synonym, but it's close to it. Mercy would take it a bit further. And the Greek word means to get into somebody else's skin, to see through their eyes, to understand what they're feeling, and then to have that feeling of mercy toward them. If I really understand where they are, then I am in a position to show them mercy. Now, there are four things that I want you to remember about mercy. Four things. Number one, when I am asked to show mercy to someone, it implies that I'm blessed. I mean, who am I for you to ask my mercy? I mean, here's a circumstance that I didn't see it coming, but here it is. And somebody is pursuing me for my mercy. Somebody is asking me for my mercy. The implied blessing is that I'm not the one asking for mercy. I'm the one being asked for it. How do you like that? Jesus said, blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. On an occasion when I'm asked for my mercy, I need to remember that there's a blessing implied here. I'm not where he is. I'm where I am. How do you like that? Number two, what I want you to remember about mercy is that when I'm asked for my mercy, at that moment, I must remember every time that I am someone who is in need of mercy, of God's mercy. Isn't that true? And this is important. For example, in Ephesians chapter 6, Paul writes and talks to the slaves. And he says, now look, you slaves, listen. I want you to serve your masters, not with eye service as men pleasers. I don't want you just to work when they're. I want you to serve them as you would the Lord. I want you to serve them as part of your Christianity. And you be good workers, good slaves. And so you hold that. And then he says, now, by the way, you masters, I want you to remember that you have a master in heaven. God's not a respecter of persons. You have a master in heaven. Now, when it comes to being merciful, I've got to remember at that moment that I am someone in need of mercy. Are you in need of God's mercy? Anybody in this room that doesn't feel like he's in need of God's mercy? Ephesians 4:32 says, be kind one to another. Listen to this, because here's how you do it. Be kind one to another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another, even as God, for Christ's sake, hath forgiven you. Number three, when I'm asked for my mercy, I need to remember that God is the originator of mercy, that he is the epitome of mercy. And so Psalm 103, beginning in verse 8, God is merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and plenteous in mercy. He will not always chide, neither will he keep his anger forever. He has not rewarded us after our iniquities or after our sins. As the heavens are high above the earth, so great is his mercy toward them that fear him. As far as the east, I love this part. I love this. So far as the east is from the west. You know what that represents is infinity. How far is the east from the west? Take a line and draw it and put an arrow on either end, and that's infinity. As far as the east is from the west, so far has he removed our transgressions from us. This is down to where I live. As a father pities his children, so the Lord pities them that fear him. Daddy, do you know what it means to pity your children? You know what? Nobody had to teach me that. I mean, when I had my babies, I knew what I felt toward them. And I love that because that's how God views you and me. For he knows our frame, he remembers that we are dust. Let me tell you something, you serve a merciful God. I mean, he loves you so much. And that very fact, that you and I serve a merciful God motivates me to be merciful myself. Of course I want to be merciful. I want to be godly. I want to be like him. But here's the fourth thing I want you to remember in reference to mercy, and the last one, is that God requires me to be merciful. Now, there's a direct line, a direct connection between my being merciful to others and God being merciful to me. I mean, we can say this plainer. If you're not a merciful person, you really oughtn't to expect God to have any mercy on you. I mean, that's just it. And so in Matthew 6:14, after Jesus finished the model prayer, he says this, for if you forgive not men their trespasses, neither will your Father forgive you your trespasses. In James 2, in about verse 13, James says, God will not have mercy on him that has not shown mercy. Same thing. But then that last part of this verse, the last part of the verse says, and mercy rejoices over judgment. What does that mean? When Caleb was little, I guess about, I don't know, five, he was a remarkable person. I mean, he was Superman and Batman at the same time. And Cindy made him costumes, and he had a cape, and he had the hat thing, you know, and he would wear his underwear on the outside, and he was about five. And so he needed someone to be the lawless one. Well, that was me. I was the bad guy, see. And I had a job. I mean, my job description was to fight Batman tenaciously, or Superman, whichever he happened to be on that day. I mean, I was to put up an awful battle, and then I was to die. That's how it worked. And so Cindy would do the camera, and, you know, the video camera, because he liked that. And Caleb would design various scenes, and here's how it's supposed to go. And we would duke it out, and then he would wallop me, and I was to lay flat on the floor, and he would stand on my chest and he would flex his arms. Now, this verse says, and I want you to love this with me. It says that mercy triumphs over judgment, rejoices over judgment. The idea is that it triumphs over it. It's that I'm going to go to the judgment day, and judgment would say, justice would say, he's a sinner. He doesn't deserve heaven. You're damned. But mercy at the hands of Jesus would say, wait a minute, I know him. I know Collie. He was baptized into my name. He wore my name. He was a member of my body, the church. And he lived and told people about me. And here's my blood to pay for his sins. And you know what? When it comes down to the mercy or the judgment, are you ready for this? The mercy triumphs. The mercy wins. And aren't you thankful? Now, with that in your heart, may I read this beatitude again? Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. And when you put it in that context, it becomes very easy for me to be merciful and compassionate to the people who are around me.